Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
All right, welcome to the first edition of Spitfire Women of Color for 2016. Spitfire is a monthly radio broadcast that airs every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. So first off, we want to acknowledge that CKUT is located on unceded Mohawk, Ganegahaka, and Haudenosaunee territory. Spitfire stands in solidarity with Indigenous resistance and firmly supports Indigenous sovereignty and self-determination.
We have a great show in store for you tonight, our first show of 2016. So this is Victoria on the mic here in Montreal CKUT studio with the lovely Spitfire hosts Mercedes.
Hi.
And Gao.
Merp, merp.
And we also have a couple of special guests sitting in with us. Sarah Balde is a third culture kid from Senegal who is passionate about writing and social justice. She writes historical fiction in her spare time and is an avid yogi.
Wow. Yes.
She is also a second year law student and total soul sister. Dear friend, welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Kasai in the studio with us. She's a total light in our Woman of Color Montreal community. Kasai is an adoptee advocate and is passionate about family preservation, adoptee rights to information, and their right to be accommodated in their birth countries. She is currently working on an anthology by Ethiopian adoptees living in Canada, U.S., and different parts of Europe. We are so thrilled to have you both with us in the studio today.
Woo!
Thank you. And after the break, we will highlight some recent current events on our radar. Then Mercedes has prepared for us a piece trending on the trending hashtag Black Girl Magic. As per usual, she will be shining the light and love on black hashtag Black Girl Magic, bringing insight to this electric phenomenon. And of course, taking to task white supremacist backlash.
Tonight, we'll also come with some literary reflection. We're going to take a moment to share our thoughts on a book we all had the chance to read since our last show, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me.
And finally, as we are wont to do periodically on Spitfire, we will be turning to the teachings of our beloved Black feminist scholar, teacher. What's going on over here? I feel like
it's a special edition. Everything's happening at once. Yeah. That's a radio, guys. Live radio.
Groove fire. Women of color radio.
There's like all these songs coming on and I'm like, what is happening? Okay. Yeah. So as I was saying, I was making love to our beloved Black feminist scholar, teacher of critical liberation theory, Sage, Lodestar, Healer, Bell Hooks. So last fall, she did her final installment of her residency lectures at the New School. And we wanted to start the year off right by going deep into some of what she talked about in her lecture called From Pain to Power.
This will segue nicely into some self-care resources that we will be sharing at the end of the show. We have some poetry from Naria Wahid Salt.
So stay tuned for Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. But now you're on your knees on the highway talking about wish we would have done shit my way. Well, there's so many things I might have done. And all these bodies trying to hold me, but they don't know me like you know me. Cha-cha.
This pain, baby, 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 baby. Oh, oh, baby, it's pleasure. This pain, oh, oh, baby, it's pleasure.
Tucked inside me like a matchbox. You know I was doomed to fall in love with you. Put a bandaid on and move forward for the time being. But I can't tell if that's my heart beating or if that's time leaving. See, I've been talking to you lately. Feels like I've been going crazy. Trying to forge a hole in time and erase all those painful places. I was only sticking to the script, dawg. You wrote, I was only giving what I get, dawg. You know, cause I can paint a picture in the sky right where you wanna be. I never said it love, but more like you is what I wanna be.
Oh, oh, but there is pleasure, this pain. Oh, oh, but there is pleasure, this pain. Pleasure, this pain. Pleasure, this pain. Pleasure this pain, pleasure this pain.
Take off my face, we done.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is now 6:11 p.m. and I'm going to say like minus 50 like outside. So it's extremely cold. Extremely cold. It's kind of saddening. Anyway, and you are just listening to Kwame Live, Pleasure This Pain, featuring Angel Hayes. Just looking back on this month, we wanted to highlight some of the eyebrow-raising headlines that we came across.
First up, the mothers of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis have both endorsed Hillary Clinton in the upcoming U.S. presidential campaign. Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon's mother, wrote of her personal meeting with Hillary in an op-ed piece for CNN. She also favors Hillary for her advocacy of the Brady Bill, which calls for required background checks for gun purchases and the assault weapon ban, as well as her opposition to immunity laws, which protect gun distributors from liability. Lucia McBath, Jordan Davis's mother, similarly supports Hillary for her stance on gun control legislature. Both mothers have actively rallied against the Stand Your Ground laws, which were cited as defense in Davis trials. So how do we all feel about the mothers of Trayvon and Jordan backing Hillary? And what do we make of this emphasis on gun control over systematic racism?
Victoria, I feel like you need to get this off your chest. I feel like you're going to explode.
Actually, no. I feel like, I don't know. I kind of feel like we don't have a lot of time to get into Hillary. It's also a question of, like, you know, like just space. But I just want to say that, like, Hillary is not on our side. She is not on the side of, like, women of color and working women and poor women and children. I'm just going to throw out some countries at Libya, Iraq, Honduras. You know, her track record is pretty bad. So just, like, you know, Google that and I'm satisfied.
Kasai, Sarah, do you guys have any thoughts? Oh, it's fine if not, man. I mean, like, everyone's like, Hillary, no.
We have I was just going to say that dealing with gun control isn't going to deal with police brutality and racial justice and racial violence that we've been seeing in the U.S. So I don't think it would even solve the problem in its totality.
Yeah, it's an ideological issue at its core, right? Moving on quickly, we have Stacey Dash, actress from Clueless, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Black Republican calling for the elimination of BET and Black History Month in a segment on Fox and Friends on the Fox Channel, which is often an institution for racist remarks. Dash remarked that either we want to have segregation or integration. She goes on to say, if we don't want segregation, then we need to get rid of channels like BET and the BET Awards and the Image Awards, where you're only awarded if you're Black. If it were the other way around, we would be up in arms. It's a double standard.
Did you guys see Gabrielle Union?
Yes, I'm just going to say that.
Stacey Dash.
She referred to Dash as a crazy lady. And well, she basically said the more... Her. She said, the more that we focus on inclusion and a true representation of this country, I think that crazy lady will have less to say.
Then she said, who's Stacey Dash? That was like
yeah,
the best.
Yeah, shade.
Everyone's saying that the shade standard has been set for 2016. But anyway, moving on.
Dash apparently asked for an apology.
She can
from
sit
Twitter
down.
Haters. She wrote a blog entitled
Morgan
Twitter
Freeman
Haters, When Do I Get My Apology for Agreeing with Morgan Freeman About Black History Month?
She can sit down. That's
she claims
she
that
do.
Morgan Freeman expressed similar views, but she actually distorted what he said.
Exactly. She needs to sit down.
She didn't say the same thing at all.
She needs to sit down. But anyway. Lastly, serial rapist and former cop Daniel Holtzclaw was sentenced to 263 years in prison. Holtzclaw, former Oklahoma City Police Department police officer, was charged with 18 counts of rape and sexual assault of African-American women in the neighborhood he was assigned to patrol. The women he targeted were black, and many had a history of drug abuse or an existing criminal record. According to The Intercept, by framing his unsolicited sexual advances as an exchange for a reprieve from warrants or jail time, he used his badge to leverage the women's backgrounds as blackmail. And I guess I can take that into my piece. So here we go. So a new wave of social media fanfare has started 2016 off with a bang for black women. This is the year where we get our props, where they're rightly deserved, and no amount of white tears is able to stop the typhoon that is hashtag black girl magic. The initial intention of the hashtag was to praise the accomplishments of black women leaving their footprints in society, where their trailblazing would otherwise be overlooked. It is a tool to continue empowering ourselves by acknowledging our self-worth and finding pride in who we are and in others. One definition that I particularly like is from Lindsay E. of the Single Black Female Project, where she says, quote, "Black girl magic, by my definition, is a term girls everywhere have adopted to describe that indescribable characteristic about us. It's what we exude. It's our je ne sais quoi. That sprinkle of magic that embodies our sassiness, our sharpness, our talent, wit, beauty, style, skill, and the list goes on. It points the finger to our mystic and one-of-a-kind creation that every black girl is born with. Hashtag Black Girl Magic puts a stamp and spotlight on our works, our interests, and our accomplishments. The thing about hashtag Black Girl Magic is that it is not limited to a certain age, social standing, or level of education. Black women, trans black women, and young girls have all been recognized for what they are bringing to the table, and this can be anything from flaunting your melanin in a selfie on Instagram, contradicting every social norm that has trapped you in a bubble, to community activism letting the world know that you are here to stay and nothing will bring you down. For example, Dr. Hadia Nicole Green, an assistant professor at Tuskegee University, has taken on the challenge of defeating cancer with the help of a $1 million grant. Or even Marley Diaz, a sixth grade girl, sick of reading about, quote, and these are her words, white boys and dogs, starting up a book drive called hashtag 1000 Black Girl Books, where black girls were the main characters in these stories because she was unable to relate or connect to the characters she was reading in books. Hashtag Black Girl Magic is a motivational tool, an inspiring tool, one more tool to dismantle the systems of oppression trying to keep us down. It is also a tool making people, white people, very uncomfortable. Hence the creation of hashtag White Girl Magic. I'm not going to get too much into it, but I assume people understand why it was created.
White girls aren't magic.
Because black women asserting pride in themselves somehow takes away from white females who feel that their struggles have been overlooked. I'm sorry your mascara didn't get recognized today. My apologies. But what was fascinating was the criticism from within the black community. Days later, Elle Magazine ran an article by Linda Chavers entitled, "Here's My Problem with Black Girl Magic. Black girls aren't magical. We're human." She argued that the phrase holds black women to unfeasible high standards, celebrating them when they achieve it, but criticizing them when they don't. She goes on to say, the strong black woman archetype, which also includes the mourning black woman who suffers in silence, is the idea that we can survive it all, that we can withstand it, that we are in fact superhuman. Black girl magic sounds to me like just another way of saying the same thing, and is smothering and stunting. It is above all constricting rather than freeing. This was also published after two black actresses, Teyonah Parris and Yara Shahidi, and one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement, Janetta Netta LZ, were featured in a special edition of Essence magazine and who spoke about black girl magic in positive terms. So with everything surrounding hashtag black girl magic, what does it mean for us as black women? Is it doing more harm than good, as Trevor points out? What can be done in the future to make sure voices are not silenced? These are questions that require deep reflection, but for this period in time, I will support and continue to believe that black girls are magic.
Yeah, I think black girls are magic too. So hashtag black girls magic, for sure. Thank you so much, Mercedes.
You're welcome.
That's really amazing piece. To Spitfire Women of Color Radio. It is 6:21. I don't know how cold it is outside, but I think it's pretty damp and cold. This is your host, Victoria, Spitfire Radio. That was Love by the legendary Erykah Badu. Yeah, what a great song. So we're going to turn now to the acclaimed and much talked about memoir turned letter to his son, Between the World and Me, by African-American writer and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates. Winner of the National Book Award this past year, 2015, actually, Between the World and Me is being celebrated as a quintessential exposition on what it means to be Black in America. Renowned African-American author Toni Morrison has called it required reading. Indeed, that Coates is essentially the next James Baldwin. While some of our favorite teachers have been scathing in their critique of his work and what it has and what it has come to represent in the mainstream discursive field. So we all had the chance to read the work over the holidays and wanted to reflect together, conversate on some of these issues. Gao, do you want to like give a brief overview of the plot and some of the main themes just for our audience, just to get them situated?
Sure. So Between the World and Me addresses a Black boy, namely Coates' son, Samori, but also Black children growing up all over the United States. In his letter to his son, Coates begins with a question. Probed by a white interviewer, he was once asked, "What is it like to lose your body?" The question burns in Coates, launching him into passages detailing how having a Black body is to have no control over that body, for it can be so easily destroyed, so easily disposed of. Yet, the fragility of the Black body calls for that very body to behave and perform with such a nuance, to follow such a strict script, whether it be on the streets of West Baltimore where Coates grew up or in the schools, where they were painted as the only escape from poverty, addiction, and imminent death for Black child. Here also, Coates delves into the intergenerational violence in Black communities, used as ways that transcend mere discipline. Iterations of Black parents explaining to their children, "Either I can beat you to death or the police will," make repeated appearances throughout. He breaks the book into three parts, using eloquent words of Black scholars before him as prefaces. He describes his journey to Howard University, where he finds the Mecca, a campus filled with the diversity of Black beauty, an epiphany for Coates. It is here that he meets Prince Jones, a Black man that is shot down by police years later, police that were assigned to protect an affluent African-American community. The truth of Prince's murder, that he was trailed by a state over and unlawfully killed, reverberates for years in Coates' mind, resurfacing with force after Darren Wilson is freed after killing Michael Brown.
So that's just like a really brief kind of introduction. I don't know if anyone else wants to add to that. There are definitely more themes and more nuances to it, more complexity for sure than I think I've given.
Yeah, why don't we open the floor up to our guests, Sierra and Kasai. What were your immediate reflections and reactions to reading the text?
I personally love the book. When I read the parts where he talked about receiving beatings from his father and just the fear that surrounded him as a result of, you know, centuries of being oppressed, it made me think about just self-love and self-care within the Black community. And I have a lot of thoughts on the book. But,
it's very intense.
Yeah, it's a really intense book, but I also have a lot of thoughts about bell hooks' critique and others' critiques of his book as well, which I felt were unfair, but we can probably talk about that a little later. I don't want to go on a monologue. So,
Kasai?
I actually haven't read the book.
Oh, okay. Mercedes?
My thoughts on the book?
Yeah, or just like, I don't know, if you have any, like, or we can go, you know, we can dive into some of these.
I think the one thing that I guess stayed with me throughout was this concept of fear. Mm-hmm. And that was actually, I got shivers with that because it makes, when you think about it, it's just like every day. It's just like, it is something that is fearful no matter what, whether you present your body in a certain way that is, you know, fit to maneuver the channels of society that have been paid for you, or even if it's just being at home, like no matter what, your parents are always going to be fearful for you. So then you're fearful for yourself and then fearful for the next generation, and just goes to, it's like this never ending of cycle of fear, because like he says, like you essentially don't control your body. Everybody exterior to that does. And I think that's something that just really stuck with me. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's just one of the things
for
that
sure
I just related with. But anyway,
so I guess my next question is, like, what do you think is the ultimate message of the book?
It's a very good question.
And then a related question being, like, who do you think is the intended or unconscious audience? And I guess I'm kind of like playing this a little tongue-in-cheek, because there is you know, there's this surrounding discourse around the book about who the intended audience is, and maybe, and you know, Dr. Cornel West.
Oh my!
You know,
I read that.
Yeah,
was
he went in, intense. and he was underscoring this, like, you know, this really deep, what to me was like a deep reflection meditation of the fear factor, you know, of being in the Black body, that dimension. And I, you know, he was pretty, he did not have very much patience for that, kind of, what was it? I don't know. I don't think do we want to read some of that, of Dr. Cornel West's critique? Well, but I know that just, my curiosity.
Like, I understand, like, what he's saying, but at the same time, it's like, well, I don't know. Personally, when I was reading this, I read this as, yes, it's a letter to his son, but also to Black men in general, more so than, let's say, Black women, mm-hmm. because our bodies are just as endangered as the Black men's, but I don't think that was mentioned as much as it should have been. Maybe that's just me.
It's so glossed over, yeah.
So then when I was reading them, like, it's great. Like, I can feel the compassion. I understand where he's coming from. But I'm reading this as someone on the outside, because mm-hmm. I don't know what it's like to be a Black man in America. I don't know what it's like to be profiled as a Black man. I don't know what it's like to automatically be seen as a threat mm-hmm. in the way that he's describing that the male Black body is seen as a threat. So it's kind of like sitting there from reading this as, like, I guess as someone who's learning. More so than someone who's there was definitely parts I could relate to, but it's not pertinent to me as a Black female.
If I may, I feel like a lot of the critiques around his work were mostly about how he didn't include gender or patriarchy, but I feel like he was writing from his own, just
exactly.
from his own experience. And the first rule for a writer is always write what you know. So I don't really think it's fair to fault him for not speaking about the Black woman's experience, for instance. And in the book, he does, when he's speaking to his son, he does say, you know, the black woman's experience is more complex than I could ever explain to you. So he acknowledges the fact that he doesn't have the know-how, the experience to really fully, you know, describe that and portray that accurately. So I think that was humble on his part. I don't see why he's getting criticized based on that point.
Gal, did you have something to say?
Yeah, like I was thinking that might have been his motive in not really talking about gender domination and patriarchy in his book, because I did feel like at times it was kind of glossed over, although I really, like, I like that he mentioned it, but I also found it weird how when he's describing the Mecca, he's like exoticizing all these black females in a way. And it's like, yes, they're so beautiful, but at the same time, I feel like their spirit doesn't really ring through in his prose. Like, it's really how beautiful they are, their dreads, or, you know, just like how exotic it is.
But he also did talk about how one of them taught him about love.
Yes,
I don't know, the parts where he described the women like made my toes curl. not just the way that, honestly, not just the way that they looked, but also just the spiritual lessons that they brought to him, and just how they enriched his life and his understanding of love. So I don't agree with that. I feel like he did portray them in
Valdez is like going to town for a town.
Yeah, I really like the book, and I'm like, stop attacking him. Not that you are. I'm just talking about the critiques that I read.
Do you you know the passage where he's kind of conceptualizing slavery as a woman? Do you remember that? I don't know.
That's the second part.
I read
part,
three
right?
quarters of the book, mm-hmm. so I may not have gotten to that part.
It's kind of shortly after that, the part where he's introduced to the Mecca, and he does conceptualize slavery as a woman. And I was like torn between whether I liked that or not, because I actually kind of liked it because it's truthful. You know, it is. Slavery is like the amount of violence that's like put on the black female's body. It kind of encapsulates slavery in a way. I don't know if that's valid,
right.
But I really like those passages at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Victoria, you haven't said anything.
Oh, so basically what I was listening to, an interview with him on the long form podcast, and he had admitted that it was not a letter to his son at the get-go. He was writing this memoir, and then during the editing process or the writing process, he decided to use that as a literary device. And of course, this is following the acclaimed, you know, The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin, where he writes a letter to his nephew talking about what it means to be black in America, or a black male in America, and specifically in relation to white supremacist domination and violence. And so, I don't know, like, so in some way, like, I feel like, you know, okay, he's not addressing different positionalities of racism and violence within the black community, within, you know, in the African American experience, but in some way, like, his work is being put up as a totalizing experience, you know, making these in relation to, like, you know, like James Baldwin being this, like, you know, a sort of legendary writer who's able to speak about African American experience. And then there's this, like, other critique where it's just like, who is the intended audience? Since it didn't really start off as a letter to your son,
who is it for?
You know, who is it really for? And there's this idea out there that it's actually for white people. It's not for black people. And it's really interesting because I was hanging out with my friend, my girlfriend in Oakland, and we were talking about Black Lives Matter. And she was just like, the hashtag Black Lives Matter is not for black people. Black people know that Black Lives Matter, you know? Black Lives Matter is to tell white people that Black Lives Matter, you know? And we can all get on board and shut this system down of, like, incredible, like, you know, violence and terrorism against African Americans, then, you know, we can go somewhere. So there's this, like, it's like an outreach thing. And so I kind of feel like on some level this book is an outreach thing to, like, white people. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, that's kind of my impression too, but I haven't read the book.
I kind of feel, and I don't know, you guys can like go to town on my interpretation of the book here, whether it's intended or unconscious. I think it's so beautiful. And I, you know, what Mercedes was saying, it's like, she's not a black male living in America, and she's not Ta-Nehisi Coates. And this is his memoir. It's his personal experience, and it's beautifully written. And, you know, what can we take away that's universal from a personal historical like situation? And for me, it's just like, it's being able to extend my empathy and to, you know, step into his experience of fear, you know, and that it's real, and that it's tied up with these like systems of oppression and like a history of like, you know, this like, you know, history of violence. And it just makes my commitment to anti-black racism so much more real and strong and like, you know, fiery and committed, right? And I kind of feel that when I got this book, like, who did I give it to? Like, I got the first Christmas present, I was like, I'm gonna give it to like my white guy friend, you know. And I feel like it's an excellent tool. It's like an excellent teaching tool to like create, you know that empathy.
But do you think because it is a memoir, it's his personal experience, that in then does he then owe it to the public to then address all the issues that he's being critiqued for glossing over?
No.
But like, who's in charge of conveying that? Like, who's in charge of inscribing those meanings?
Well, yeah, exactly. But I just feel like he's been given like a kind of...
But can we truly like fault him for the kind of acclaim he gets?
I'm not going to go there at all. Yeah, I'm not going there at all. That's not what I'm saying.
But I agree with what Sarah said about... like, and he does make it clear that, I mean, he is writing from, like, a sort of personal experience. Like, it's, I mean, we can have debates about, like, who the intended audience was. But I saw Ta-Nehisi Coates when he came to McGill in the winter. And I find he's a very humble. Like, and he's, like, I really liked him. And the facilitator was great, too, Rachel. But I do feel like it's like it comes from a good place. But I feel like the sort of the positive critique, like, I mean, what Toni Morrison said about him resembling James Baldwin, like, that's like that's huge, like, to say that. Which I haven't read the book, so I can't like really say too much. But I'm kind of like, ooh, because I've heard some good things from people that have read it, but I've also heard some critiques, and Bell Hooks was pretty brutal with her. But I kind of, I don't know, like I like critiques too. So I was like, yeah.
But just to go back to who his audience is, and not to take anything away from Black activists and, you know, people that are at the forefront of the Black Lives Matter movement, racial equality cannot be reached like alone. Like, we need other communities' help, and we need other people to kind of tune in and be committed to anti-Black racism, as you said earlier, Victoria. So even if his audience is white, that could be beneficial at the end of the day. If reading his book opens your eyes to the reality of the Black life experience in the U.S., then I think that's a positive.
So then what does that mean for the Black people reading this? Like, if we wanted to relate to this.
I enjoyed it too, though. I'm Black. Just by the way.
Mercedes, I think Mercedes, right? Do you identify as Black?
I'm starting to question that. No, I'm not. I'm definitely Black. But it's, but it's just, I don't know. It's because, like, it's great. It's a tool for educating, but it's just still, then it's, where does that leave me? Because now I'm still in a void where it's like, I want to be able to jump in and do my part, but it's like, well, okay, great, it's for white people, it's for Black men, but
there's such a pool out. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Go.
I was just gonna say there's such a pool of like knowledge and wisdom and beauty that like Black feminist scholars have written for us, you know, for Black women,
yeah,
especially,
for sure.
And and you know, we don't necessarily need, I mean, I say we, but I'm not Black, no. So you know,
But it's really interesting what he prescribes as the answer for his son at the end of the book, right? You know, so at the end of the book, it's like, you know, so there's a lot of like meditations on violence against the Black body, and how you have to, he's like, you know, continually cautioning his son that he needs to take care of himself, you know, essentially, right? That's the message. And then at the very end, there's like this, you know, you're not going to change. You don't need to be, I think it's, you know, you don't need to be accepted by white society. You don't need to convert white society. It's not your job. But just like, you know, kind of, I feel like the last words were something about like, you know, reveling and being nostalgic about what it means to be Black, you know, and all the wonderful things that you can, you know, gain spiritual sustenance from in being who you, you know, being of your people.
In the talk from Pain to Power, sorry if I interrupted you. Bell Hooks was talking about how the culture of domination that we live in always wants us to think of power as outside ourselves. I'm quoting her here. And then she went on to say, we often internalize that sense of powerlessness, and in so doing, we embrace death. And so she basically was saying how this speaks to the importance of not relying on external validation, but finding ways to kind of, you know, self-nurture and like care for ourselves and validate ourselves. So I feel like that speaks to,
that was my critique of it. Like, I felt like he spent a lot of time in the fear, you know, and that's why it's not for his son. It's to tell white people, like, this is how shitty it is to be in this, like, you know, totally brutalized, you know, body. Right. And so that's why, like, when I, you know, and we're going to go to this talk now and we can maybe come back to this question, but it's like mapping the politics of power in terms of his writing as a creative work of the imagination, and like where's the pain, and where's, you know, because her talk is like moving from pain to power, and it's like where, like, how much time does he spend in pain and how does he get to power, you know? And so, like, and we can talk about Black Girl Magic as a hashtag too, and it's like, you know, how is that, how do we map moving from pain and domination culture and being alienated to empowerment and self-empowerment, and what kind of tools do we have available to us, you know?
So do you mean that he failed to describe how he overcame that fear? So even though he was trying to talk about overcoming fear, he didn't really describe the process. He kind of just, you know, went from speaking about fear to speaking about self-validation.
Yeah, in a very, right? in like one paragraph, some nostalgia, you know, of like, you know, we have this really rich culture and we can't forget that. But I spent like a lot of the book was trying to like make an argument for how, you know, how much this brutalization is. And, you know, and we'll like hear it in this talk with Bell Hooks, where she's just like, how many times do I have to look at the image of a Black woman being beaten? That's why she didn't like 12 Years a Slave, because she wants to create different kinds of imagined visions, you know? So her argument is that, like, you know, as creatives, as thinkers, like, what are we going to do to, you know, step into power? And that's why she didn't, I don't know, but I got a feeling this is maybe one of the reasons why she didn't like the book.
Because it took her back to a place of fear instead of helping her move past it as a reader, maybe.
Right. And, like, you know, we didn't get to hear the clip from, like, Erykah Badu, but, like, you know, she suggests that there are only two emotions that you can be in. It's, like, love or fear. Right? So we have to, like, go to Bell Hooks now, and then we'll be back. So we're going to switch gears.
Actually, Mapping Desire, Archaeologies of Change was sort of the overall rubric for the residency, and this particular conversation has to do with moving from pain to power. How do we, as people from oppressed and exploited groups, find our way to joy, find our way to emotional well-being, to healing? And today I was in Judy's class, and they were reading Choosing the Margin as a Space of Radical Openness. And I was like, that Bell Hooks, she's smart. This is a really good essay. So I'm just going to read a few sentences. I said, as a radical standpoint, perspective, position, the politics of location necessarily calls those of us who would participate in the formation of counter-hegemonic cultural practice to identify the spaces where we begin the process of revision. For many of us, the movement requires pushing against oppressive boundaries set by race, sex, class, domination. Initially, then, it is a defiant political gesture Moving, we confront the realities of choice and location. Within complex and ever-shifting realms of power relation, do we position ourselves on the side of colonizing mentality or decolonization? I was saying earlier to Darnell that I was a younger person when I first read Even Vansertimus, They Came Before Columbus, and I heard him interviewed on the radio, and he kept saying, we have not just been colonized in our minds, we've been colonized in our imaginations. So part of what we want to talk about today is how do we decolonize? How do we use our imaginations in the service of our well-being? Parents, Black parents who perceive a child to be gay or to be becoming gay, and a lot of times the oppression that that child suffers as people try to beat it out of him or her, and so how do you change that? How do you change years of being told something very negative about who you could possibly be? And that, I think, again, has to begin with the imagination.
I think, yes, it begins with the imagination, but I think it also begins with self before we can actually look out at the larger community. And so we've been told so often, whether we've had nurturing, whether we've grown up in nurturing homes or not, we've constantly faced with this, who we are is not good enough. It's not okay. We need to strive to be this other thing that's not us. And so we look at our flaws, which are magical, and our imperfections, which are magical, and we chastise ourselves in our minds and in our imaginations with that. And instead we try to imagine ourselves as something other than perhaps what we are. And I think one of the first things that we have to begin to do is sit and look in the mirror and be okay with who we are.
Well, I think that I was thinking a lot about how much a culture of domination always wants us to think of power as outside ourselves. So that we think of power as, I'll get this fabulous career or this fabulous partner or this fabulous amount of money. But power is always conceived as power over something and not as, what is my power within? And so I feel that part of our colonization as brown people, Black people, Asian people, is we often internalize that sense of powerlessness because we feel like, well, what's my power in relationship to the world? I don't have any, you know? And so I think that we often embrace death. You know, my brother, who's 60-some years old, a recovering addict for 25 years, just really beats himself up for not having money. And I say to him, Ken, look at the blessing of your life. How many working class Black men can come back from addiction, can be born again in recovery? But on his scale of evaluation, that doesn't mean anything. And so part of what I learned early on is we have to change the scale of evaluation. Because if we continue to judge ourselves by the standards set within that imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, then we never move. Because even if we move, but we still have what I call the voice of judgment. My theory is that the dominating culture depends on the voice of judgment. You know, that even when you're succeeding, you're not good enough. Even when, you know, I didn't think I was a writer, even after I had books published. Because, you know, for me, you know, what did I think a writer would be? What would be the magic moment that I could say, I'm a writer? And that whole thing had to do with my needing some type of validation outside myself to give me power and not to be able to think of, you know, power that I can give myself, that we can self-generate. And I worry, and I talked a little bit, and we're not going to talk about Black Lives Matter tonight, but I was saying sometimes I worry because so many of our energies of protest and resistance are outer directed. You know, last night I asked the audience, what if we took away all the police brutality in our society against Black males? Would Black males be self-actualized? Is it really police brutality that is keeping Black males from, you know, I mean, I think about, I mentioned my brother last night, how my father used to say to him, Glory, to me, Glory, your brother ain't worth a nickel. And he loved putting my brother down. I mean, it's amazing that my brother could come out of addiction. You know, when I hear people like putting little Black children and boys, especially, you stupid, you dumb, down, you think, how will that person empower themselves from that? I mean, the hostility that people directed towards me when I said, no, I didn't like 12 Years a Slave, that if I didn't see another movie where a Black woman was being beaten and raped and abused as long as I lived, I would be fine. Because what is that image doing? I think when we watch certain images over and over again, what the message they give us is there's no way out. No matter what you do, no matter where you go, you can't get out. Because you can't get out as long as you're saying no. And so, I mean, even in thinking about who could be on this panel, I had to really think about who are the people that say yes to themselves. You know, I had been with Marcy as a friend through the profound grief, because saying yes doesn't mean you get away from pain, that she felt a lot of grief over her relationship ending. But, you know, it's again, what do you do with that grief? How do you use it? How do you turn it into Marcy growing as a self in the world so that she's not stuck? Because a lot of us are stuck. We're stuck in the abuse of childhood. We're stuck in the abuse of adulthood. We're stuck in the teacher telling us we're dumb and stupid. And those tapes just play over and over. So we can say that part of the movement from pain to power, power as agency over our lives, is getting rid of those tapes. And it sounds simple, but it's an ongoing process. Which is, of course, if we read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning about the Nazi Holocaust, and I mean, he talks so deeply about the role of the imagination. What keeps you going? What does the imagination make possible? And so when we think about fantasy, there's that line between fantasy and the imagination. Because if we get addicted to fantasy, then we trance and we never come back to reality. I always say to people, I like the definition of insanity that says it's when you're not in reality. And my people, as Zora Neale Hurston would say, a lot of us are not in reality. We are fantasizing a life, or which is different from imagining a life. Because whenever you concretely imagine in a real way, you also do have to imagine what are the concrete steps that are going to get me there. And that is, you know that little, I think they have it at the Buddhist Museum, there's a statement that says you don't know how strong you are until you know how strong love makes you. But you can't get to the love until you start with that self. It's like you got like a piece of fruit where you got to cut off the rotten parts. You can't get to the well-being without doing that.
Hi, this is Spitfire Women of Color Radio. You were just listening to Bell Hooks, acclaimed Black liberation feminist scholar critic. She was speaking at the New School earlier this fall. It's part of a New School residency series that's been taking place for the last 3 years. Spitfire has been sort of following her guest lectures, and because we love her, she's so amazing, she's so wise. We have so much material to share with you on her. We're going to have to follow up later on in this month, but we just wanted to put that out there, and sort of we listen to the talk, and you guys can listen to the talk too by going onto your internet devices and looking up Bell Hooks, moving from pain to power, and you'll find the New School lecture on YouTube, and you can listen to the full hour, and it's super amazing. We just gave you a little taste there, and I just wanted to give the opportunity to these like super brilliant, amazing ladies in the studio to just throw out some reflections on their viewing of the video. Sira, Kasai, So in the video, Bell Hooks basically charts out how she thinks that we as marginalized, you know, people who have experienced trauma can move from pain, from places of stasis, maybe even places of fear, to places of self-empowerment and empowerment. And like one of the things that she and her guests talked about on the clip was like saying yes to oneself. So can you guys like unpack that a little bit? Like, what does it mean to say yes to oneself in terms of the way Bell Hooks was talking about it?
I think she was, when she said say yes to oneself, she was like the context of it was raising children and having kids hear no their entire lives and how that blocks their ability to self-actualize as adults, which I think is true to a certain extent. Because I don't think we get everything we want, even as adults. Like you encounter obstacles and challenges, and so yeah, I think there's a fine line between saying yes and all the time, and then saying no occasionally. It's I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of like when she was saying just here on the clip when she was talking about like, you know, if you are gay and your family is not open to that, they're gonna try to beat it out of you. Mm-hmm. You know.
She talked about that, and she also talked about like the whole structure of like patriarchy and sexism and how that sort of stops us from saying yes to ourselves because we've like internalized so much hate, so much negativity. And so that part really spoke to me because I was like, yes, like we do say no to ourselves, like on a very deep level, because I felt like this her talk was very deep. Like, we could talk about this for, like, 2 hours.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it for 2 hours.
But I really, really like what she said about that. It's like, to me, it was like, yes, on a really deep level. Like, yes to yourself. Like, you know, just, like, your true self. Because a lot of us as Black people, people of color, we say no to ourselves, like, on a very deep level.
Right.
So,
because domination culture says no to you and says that you're not worthy of, like, you know, right to life, right to self-actualization. And so there's the external no, but then the no gets internalized. Mm-hmm. And so it's, like, what I think is so amazing is that she is like, defining the space that you own, that is you, that, like, you know, you can actually for yourself choose to say yes for yourself. And that's like the start of like the seed of your empowerment.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to fear as well. Coates in his book said that fear transforms into violence. And so we say no and we are told no in order to avoid encountering that violence out in the real world as well. So I just thought that was.
Yeah. And it's also, I don't know, maybe there's also like this expectation that if we say no to ourselves, then it's just that things will play out as they should. Because the moment we say yes and we find that empowerment, somehow that becomes a threat to which no just becomes the end all be all answer. So I think it's, like you said, it's this idea of this concept of fear, but also by saying yes as well, there's a certain level of fear in that as well. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, you're taking the chance to be like, yes, I am going to empower myself. And yes, I will overcome. But at the same time, it's something that's also fearful because no one expects you to say yes, not even yourself.
I think it's really interesting because there's also like a predictability in the consequences of saying no. Because it's already been laid out. You've seen it before. It just means more of the same old, you know? And then when you say yes, it's like a possibility. And what is possibility? It's like unpredictability, which is like, oh my God, like I can't predict. It will not be a repetition of this like alienating realism, you know? And so I feel like that's, I see what you're saying. Or I don't know. That's what I was kind of responding to.
That's what I'm saying. Mm.
But it's really interesting because, you know, she's talking about, you know, what you're saying, Sarah, about like the power being, it's like it's the power is, or was it Kasai, like the power is within. And when I think of the title Between the World and Me, I feel like there's the world out there and there's me over here, mm-hmm. and there's all this like violence and police brutality between me and the world. And the world for Ta-Nehisi Coates in this title is like also equal to actualization or engagement with the world or having creative power in order to be in the world or like, you know, having the space, you know. And it's just like he sees that there's this gap, and like I feel like with bell hooks's formation of the geography of power and power and selfhood, it's like it's the world is within, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's not exterior.
Yeah, she in the talk she talked about how we have to see our homes as spaces of resistance, because this was when she talked about violence that she encountered in her childhood. I think her father, you know, was disciplined her with really brute force, and she also spoke of how her dad would often tell her brother that he wasn't worth a nickel. Did you guys see that part?
Yeah.
And so she said, you know, we have to, there's one line that she used that I really liked. I can't find it right now. But basically how we have to provide a counter narrative within the home to whatever's going on out there in the world. That we can't let all the negativity affect our life experience.
That's true.
Yeah.
And this is like, there's just so much in this, right? It's like an hour, but it feels like you're on like some meta journey, like super.
It's very intense.
It's so intense. So we're going to revisit this. She does say, this is, I feel like, a really wonderful invitation to the artists, the creatives, the thinkers out there to be able to, you know, step into empowerment through creativity. And she speaks on language and the need to create the new language in order to define oneself in this realm of possibility of imagining a world where, you know, Black people are loved and like, you know, all people of color are like actualizing, and it's not something we can necessarily see. So in that spirit, I would like to pass the mic to my co-host, dear sister Gao, who has brought some poetry to the table for us, and she's going to be reading some new work.
Yeah, so as we come to the close of the show, I wanted to leave you with some parting words from poet artist Nariya Waheed and her first book of poetry, The Phenomenally Moving Salt. I begin with the release. Decolonization requires acknowledging that your needs and desires should never come at the expense of another's life energy. It is being honest that you have been spoiled by a machine that is feeding you, not feeding you freedom, but feeding you the milk of pain. Why can we never talk about the blood of our ancestors, the blood of our history, the blood between our legs? And that one is entitled Blood. When you remove them from your nucleus, your being is then allowed to focus its power on turning your life into your soul's work. You become yours again. Decolonization Center. Audrey wrote of the secret poetry. We all know this poetry, lining our arms, rusting our teeth, walking through our hair, feeding our wild stomach, soothing our mouth, tears, folding itself into waists, between legs, always climbing up our sadness into our necks to sleep. The secret poetry. When you tell yourself you can have your energy back after years of giving it to white people and their requirements for acceptance, for supple colonization, digesting their beliefs, thoughts, opinions of you. This one is entitled African American 2. I lost a whole continent from my memory. Unlike all other hyphenated Americans, my hyphen is made of blood, feces, bone. When Africa says hello, my mouth is a heartbreak because I have nothing in my tongue to answer her. I do not know how to say hello to my mother.
Thank you so much, Gao.
Yeah.
So That brings us to the end of our show. Thank you to our guests, Sira and Kasai. This is really fun. It was wonderful to have your voices on air tonight with us.
Thank you for having us. This was really fun for us too.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca. And I remember you and the flowers in your hair. How I promised you I always will have your back. But can you love me despite the cracks?
Can you love me?
Can you love me despite the cracks? Oh, oh, but there is pleasure, there's pain.
Oh, oh, but
there is pleasure, there's pain. Pleasure this pain, pleasure this pain, baby, 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 baby.
Oh, oh,
but there is pleasure this pain.
Oh, oh, but
there is pleasure this pain, pleasure this pain, pleasure this pain, baby, baby, baby.
My memories ain't the best, you know. I don't like feeling like the rest of the